Is anybody there?
Jack, 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 Jack.
Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. I'm Barney Hoskins, and I'm here with Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And Jasper Morrison Bowie.
Hello, Barney.
And for this episode, we are delighted to welcome the dynamic transatlantic duo of Luke Haynes and Peter Buck. Hi, fellas.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Luke and Peter combined forces to make 2020's Beat Poetry for Survivalists, and this month release their second collaboration, All the Kids Are Super Bummed Out. Great title. We'll talk about the album, and we'll also touch on your former bands and their relationships, your relationships with music journalism and music journalists. But Luke, how did you guys hook up in the first place?
I do paintings that I sell on the internet from time to time. And I was in a series of Lou Reed paintings, and one day Peter's name popped up in my whatever shop, my internet shop, when I was at the doctor's. I was fine, by the way. And I thought, is that Peter Buck? Peter Buck. And so obviously it was. I thought, that's great. So I did Peter a painting, and I think I sent Peter an email saying, we should do an album together. To which he promptly replied, I'm a bit busy, if I remember correctly. And then he did it then, I think about a few weeks later, he sent a demo to me. And that's how it started, really. That's about right, isn't it, Peter, I think?
Yeah, I was actually right in the middle of making a record. And I just thought, that sounds great, but this very day I'm busy. But I think a week later, a week or two later, I wrote and just said, hey, what if I just started sending you stuff? And
yeah.
If memory serves, the album is chronological in the order I sent them to him. So
it is, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the first album. That's Beat Poetry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. And what was your, like, did you have a kind of mission statement for your collaboration?
I think the original thing when you're doing something like that is just to sort of, is to kind of dive in and see if it can work. And it, I think it was apparent quite early on that it was working and there was going to be something good going to come out of it. And then it just sort of, my memory of it is that the demos just sort of kind of got better and better. And then the demos became, I suppose, the masters, because we didn't kind of re-record anything. We just added stuff. So it was a good way. It was very kind of immediate. And yeah, it was a very immediate way of working. If there was a mission statement, well, obviously, I mean, you know, it kind of completely predicted COVID, but
that was the mission.
That was all right.
COVID. Yeah.
That was okay, you know. Yeah.
Given that we knew that was coming, we think we would have found a better week to put the record out.
Yeah, but we knew that's why we did it. You said we wanted to be we could say all this. So yeah,
because you were going to come and play the 100 Club, weren't you? In literally like was it March or April 2020 to promote the record? I think, weren't you? And you had to pull the plug on that, and then you eventually played that 2 years later.
Mm.
Yes,
yeah, and I got COVID on the last show. In the middle of the show.
Well, there's sort of poetic sort of
appropriateness. I felt really spiritual, and I was like, man, I'm really connected to the music. And then I went, who's that singing? That's really weird. Yeah. Like, I just, you know, I had a really high fever, so I had to retire to my motel in Chiswick for 10 days.
Jeez.
Right. I remember in the show looking round at you when you do your kind of one, you know, you turn around and you kind of do an occasional sort of glance at the kind of the guitar player, you. And I remember like, God, Peter's looking pretty ill. What the, what's going on? So, yeah.
So is that's going to be the live album, is it?
It's good show. Yeah, why not?
It's a good show. Great. Yeah. Did you, you know, obviously, for some people, this is an unlikely marriage of minds and talents. Are there areas of music, specific like influences that you two cohere around? And I'm thinking of, you know, I listen to both the records and enjoy them very much. And I sort of hear little bits of Soft Boys, even The Only Ones in there. And I don't know whether those are things that you have in common or ever talk about, like Robin Hitchcock or anyone like that.
I've got to say, I mean, I'll just jump in and Peter can, because there has been a few things, people, there's been a few things whenever records get reviewed, it's kind of, they say it's a really strange pairing. I don't really get that at all. I mean, it's, why, I don't know why it is, because we kind of, you know, we've probably got a lot of records that we listen to in common, and I don't know why. I don't know. What do you think, Peter?
You know, people always ask me about things like this, and I just go, you know, I have more in common with a 21-year-old African-American hip-hop guy than I do with a 60-year-old white insurance salesman. You know,
yeah,
musicians have a lot more in common than you might think. And
yes,
I'm sure we've read a lot of the same books and listened to the same music. And, you know, it also, this is what you do. You write. And I have friends that I've attempted to write with, and it just doesn't work very well because we have such different ways of writing a song. And with Luke, it was like, yeah, I sent him a song, he did it, and I sent him another and he did that. It seemed simple from my end.
Peter, do you get a chuckle when lyrics such as Andy Warhol was not kind come back over the ocean?
Well, generally I'm trying to pick up the cultural references that aren't specifically American. So, you know, like the first song on the first record, the Jack Parsons song, I knew who Jack Parsons was. I have no idea what those kids talking and yelling were about. So I had to write Luke, who explained it to me, and I actually found all that stuff on YouTube. So now I'm au fait with those English ghost kids. So,
right.
But yeah, but, you know, it's a lot of the language is fairly similar, you know, in that I think that when we grew up playing, I'm sure that Luke listened to the Velvet Underground in the same way that I did. And, of course, the Beatles. I mean, that was from their kids. All that stuff crosses through there.
Yes.
And there seems to be a lot of T-Rex in the first one, too.
Yeah. I mean, and that's sort of the kind of the sort of the language of pop or rock, whatever you want to call it, or anything else. It tends to be quite – it kind of is a language of its own anyway. So I'm not sure, you know, there's the kind of the old – thing about, you know, English and American separated by the same language, all that kind of nonsense. But I don't think that's true in sense of rock and roll music. Just the English do it in a kind of a different way. It's kind of a bit more skewed from the English. And but when I notice when I play with Americans, it's much more kind of, it's kind of rock, which is in a way that English people can't really do, if that makes any sense at all.
Yes. I mean, your lyric writing, Luke, has always been very sort of dyspeptic in a very kind of British way, I would say. And I suppose that's something that I don't kind of associate with the music that, Peter, you've made over the years. So when I say that it's quite an unusual melding of minds, it is a very transatlantic kind of collaboration, isn't it? I reread Bad Vibes ahead of this.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just laughing out loud on the beach in Sifnos. You're asking me where I was, and I was this, you know, English guy cackling with laughter at just the sheer savagery of your attacks on your Britpop contemporaries. I mean, I can hear that same sort of wit and humor in these songs, of course, you know, something that's unique to you, I think. Would that be fair to say?
I don't know. I've never really thought about it, to be honest. I just, you know, it's all pretty kind of, it's just the older I get, the less I think about it and the easier it gets. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. I mean, I might be, for all I know, I might be just like churning out absolute garbage. I mean, I don't know. No, who knows? I mean, it's not. I mean, I think it's all right. I think it's pretty good, and I've been doing it long enough. But I never really kind of examined it. I don't know. I think if I kind of examined it too much, it might be a mistake. I'm sure Peter's never really, or maybe I'm wrong. You just sort of do it, don't you? It's just you know, like, geez, you know.
Yeah, every now and again, you get that feeling that it's 2 a.m. You're trying to finish a song, and you just think, no one on earth can possibly be waiting for this. What is it I'm trying to accomplish here?
Yeah.
But if I don't do that, then I'm just sitting looking at the ceiling. So, you know, it's a reason to keep going.
It's a choice.
I think
it's
you
a
do,
straight
I think,
choice.
I think you do have to kind of, you have to kind of cast aside the kind of, you have to work in a spirit of kind of blind optimism that in some way it does matter. but it probably doesn't. And people, you know, if you kind of think about, you know, if anyone, you know, there's a high possibility that no one gives a shit. You know, I think you just have to plow through that one.
Do you guys, I mean, it's difficult not to detect a certain kind of apocalyptic bent in some of these songs. Do you guys talk about how you sort of see the world, see the music business, compare notes on your experiences in music, or is it literally just sending stuff through the ether?
There's a bit of, I mean, I suppose we discuss a few things on the email and stuff, but I mean, it's generally, we just sort of, it's fairly unspoken, isn't it, really? I mean, we just kind of do it, and it's, there's been nothing, you know, that's been kind of like, I can't work on this, or I don't think I've sent anything to Peter that has, you know, really kind of offended him or thought this is a step too far, or, you know. And that's a good way to work. I don't think you want to be, you almost want to be working on a kind of subconscious level, really. As Peter said, it's like, you know, I have friends I've known well, and I couldn't work with them, but, you know, this just seems to work.
Did you do the entire thing remotely from one another, sending files back and forth?
Yeah, the first record, we'd never met. And the record was mastered, and Filthy Friends did a show in London, and Luke came, and we had drinks for an hour. And then the plan was, well, of course, we're getting together to do the tour, and we'll hang out, and we'll make a next record in the studio. And everyone, we don't need to go into what happened in 2020, yeah. But that didn't happen either. So the next record, at this point, I'd known Luke other than email for 1 hour, and we did the entire second record and mastered it before we hung out to rehearse for the last tour.
Right. No, I mean, it's interesting because in 1988, I was working with an engineer who was making an album with Buffy St. Marie. Extraordinarily, she's a real pioneer of remote working like that. Mm. He was in London. She was in America. And using an ISDN line, they were sending files back and forth. They never actually met for the process of making it. And that's in 1988. So, you know, now
that's pretty radical, yeah.
So now it's kind of, not the new normal, but I suspect a lot of people work in this way.
There are a lot of ways to make records. And as much as I love getting in the room with a bunch of people and playing, sometimes it just doesn't work.
Yeah,
and, you know, honestly, if we had followed the plan and had got the five of us in a room to perform the new songs, it wouldn't sound like this.
Right.
And a lot of the stuff that's, some of my favorite stuff on the record is completely untethered from any band existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting.
Luke, I mentioned that I'd reread Bad Vibes and just laughed so much at your, what you said, the Lance Corporals of the Melody Maker and NME in the 90s. And I was just thinking, is this guy just willfully self-sabotaging or what? I mean, what was the fallout from? I know a little bit about the fallout from that book, but I mean, is there still?
I don't know.
Fallout?
You tell me. I don't know. I've got a clue.
It's rare to find someone so sort of gleefully burning bridges.
Yeah,
but what repeatedly happens is that you've sort of slagged off like Noel Gallagher. I mean, quite rightly. And then he comes up to you and tells you he loves your songs. And there's a few examples of that, aren't there?
Yeah. I mean, it's a strange. I mean, I think if you do, I mean, what the aftermath of that was from some of the musicians. I mean, a lot of people took it really well. I think if you do something with a certain amount of panache, you can get away with it. So, most people took it pretty okay. I was surprised about. I mean, at the time, I didn't really care.
I was going to say, were you disappointed?
No, I wasn't really thinking. When I wrote the book, I was thinking maybe I won't make any more records anyway. So it didn't really matter. Or even if I was making records, I would, you know, that's what needed to be done at the time. And I got all that stuff out of my system so it can, you know, well, I'm free to kind of go on and not have to think about the 90s too much anymore. Not that, you know, the 90s was fine. I mean, you know, without all that stuff. The thing is, without all that Britpop stuff, we would have sold a lot less records. So we did sell, because of it, we sold more records, even though I thought it was like garbage.
For any listeners who aren't aware, the subtitle of Luke's book, Bad Vibes, is Britpop and My Part in Its Downfall. It's a fascinating thing to revisit, whether it's about Suede or Pulp, or because you're on the same label as Pulp, mm-hmm. And so forth. Mm. So yeah, I really enjoyed rereading it. Just on the subject of like music journalism and, you know, the relationships you guys have had with music journalism and the rock press. Peter, one of the best pieces we have on Rock's Back Pages, in my opinion, is the 1994 interview you did with Anthony DeCurtis about quote-unquote rock criticism. I think it's called Rock Criticism and the Rocker.
Not my title.
Not your I figured it wasn't your title. It's quite a DeCurtis title. From a man who at that point was, you know, one of the biggest rock stars in the world, it's a really thoughtful conversation about the impact that music journalism had on you, as well as about REM's relationship with the music press. Do you remember having that conversation with Anthony?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, we were friends. And,
yes.
You know, and I've been, so much of how I learned about music was reading the journalism. And I was lucky to read things, you know, about the Velvet Underground when I was 13, you know, and I'm like, oh, I'll go discover that band. And probably my sensibility is more in tune with someone who intellectualizes their appreciation of music as opposed to the kid who drives around in his car with an 8-track drinking beer. I was that guy too. But you know, rock criticism, you know, I find less of it exciting right now. But, you know, in the mid-70s, you know, with Lester Bangs and all the great people going on, you really found something that you could say, okay, this is telling me something about this world that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm. In that piece, you mention our dear friend John Mendelsohn, who probably only John Mendelsohn can rival Luke Haynes in terms of the sort of splenetic diatribes about other musicians. Mark can bear me out here.
Yeah.
John, who I think is the funniest rock writer ever. I'm not sure you could probably count the number of positive pieces, Mark, couldn't you?
Yeah, no,
John,
I mean,
has written hand.
When he was a guest on our podcast, he said this marvelous thing. He said, John Landau said to him one day, "Do you actually like rock?"
I also, what I kind of really picked up in that interview with Anthony is how difficult it was being like growing up in the South and sort of essentially being more interested in the New York Dolls than the Allman Brothers, which is probably something you have in common with, you know, the few people that followed like Big Star in Memphis, right? I remember doing a big piece on Big Star and talking to, you know, people like Peter Holsapple or just people who were really, really intrigued by Big Star because they weren't the Allman Brothers. And it was like, how did this band come out of Memphis? So did you feel like, you know, you were subscribing to the Village Voice pitch, I think, when you were like, you know, 14 and reading about the sort of the New York bands and so forth. I mean, did you feel very much like a fish out of water in Georgia?
I don't think I felt like I fit in anywhere on earth, like most teenagers, mm-hmm. you know, and partially because of the journalism I'd read and the books I was reading and just that world. It was like, yeah, nobody in this entire town listens to the same music I do. Nobody, except for my two friends who I'd managed to turn on to a couple things, you know, but I just figured like, well, that's good. I'm not like these fucking losers, you know, because I mean, I'm sure they're lovely people and all that, but Roswell, Georgia in 1971 was not a place where you wanted to think about anything. I mean, so yeah, it was a way to find myself and books also, you know, I mean, I was the only guy reading like Kerouac and Norman Mailer and, you know, anything of that nature because no one was. Nobody. You couldn't find that stuff in the bookstores. You couldn't find it in the schools. It was like I'd have to read something that someone mentioned that, oh, this was a good book. And then they'd have to go to a library 20 miles away and check it out. And it was searching was a huge part of what my life was. This world I'm in does not make any sense at all. So I'm going to find a world that does.
Right. Yeah, well, that makes sense to us. I beg your pardon. Go ahead.
So I was just going to ask Peter, like the end of that Anthony de Curtis piece, you talk about how you have a lot of friends who are critics because your interests are the same and you're still reading fanzines and listening to all kinds of different music. So two questions. First of which, do you still give lots of attention to just exploring as much music as you can? And second, is there an alternate universe where you might have been a music critic rather than a musician?
Ideally, I mean, you know, I didn't think there was a chance in hell being, you know, I lived in a small town in Georgia. I never met anyone who liked the same music I liked. Wasn't until I got to Athens that I started meeting people who definitely had we had at least some similarities musically. I kind of assumed, well, maybe I'll just write about this stuff. And it could have happened. I never got around to doing it, you know. sure. I don't know why. But there wasn't anywhere, you know, the high school newspaper, no. And, you know, the Athens Banner Herald. I mean, you know, they didn't write about music, you know, so it might have been something I would have pursued if the band hadn't come along.
Luke, did you ever read the American music press, or was it just the UK Inkies when you were growing up and getting into music?
Well, I started reading the kind of the music press at about 13. So it would have been Sounds. Was what I used to read. I don't know why I was more drawn to Sounds than the NME or the Melody Maker. And I read Sounds for years.
Was that your fondness for Oi which led you towards Sounds?
Well, I used to like Dave McCulloch's writing. About all the kind of sort of Liverpool bands and the Four and all those kind of things and sort of what's now called post-punk. I'm not sure it ever was really at the time, but...
Oh, it was, it was at the time, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, you say that.
We've been into search on Rock's Back Pages for the first reference to the term, Mark.
Well, yeah. let me do that straight away while
do
you
that in
carry,
live time.
Carry talking amongst yourselves.
All right. I obviously later on I discovered things like Cream and, you know, things like that and, you know, likes of Lester Bangs, all those kind of people. But that seemed a very different kind of form of writing to me. And you can look back on it now, it's quite, I mean, I think some of the kind of American stuff from the mid 70s is actually superior to the kind of British writing of that period. It seems that it wasn't really until the late 70s that British writers got into their stride.
Funny enough, the first reference I found to post-punk is
Tommy
John
Steele.
John Savage in Sounds in 1978.
Right. Okay. Right. Well, we'll have that then. Okay. But
there it is.
But that was only because it wasn't coined as a thing. That was just,
sure. Okay.
It was just within a sentence of that something being the whatever the you know I'm trying to think of a band. I can't think of a band. The Mekons. Mekons are post-punk. Something like that, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
I'm not giving up.
No, you never do, which is great. Quite right. So part of the reason for featuring you both on the home page this week is the anniversaries of the first Auteur single, Showgirl, and of REM's Chronic Town EP and the classic Automatic for the People album. There's a very early REM interview from New York Rocker, January 1982, very early. Although, Mark, we have an even earlier.
Yeah, this is absolutely fantastic. You guys sent a demo to New York Rocker in 1981, and Gary Sparazza reviews your demo in September 81 and raves about it. It's absolutely fantastic in their pick hits section. And he says, at the end of his review, he says, do send a follow-up.
That's brilliant.
So, I mean, for us to have a review of your demo before we released any records on Rock's Back Pages gives me a great deal of pleasure.
And there's also a very early interview with you, Luke, from Melody Maker from December 1992. Yeah, which was Simon Price, might have been one of the earliest journalists to remark on the Auteurs. I took a showgirl for my ride. My life would be right, took her bowling, got her high, going to ask you, you know, you beat me to your question, Jasper, asking Peter whether he might, in an alternative universe, have become a rock critic. But the same could apply to both of you, I think, because you both write and articulate what music is so well. I mentioned Automatic for the People, and as I say, that most beloved, probably most beloved of REM albums, I don't know, is exactly 30 years old this week. For that reason, we've added an audio interview with you, Peter, and Mike Mills from August 1982, and the album's about to come out. Mark is going to tell us a little bit about this audio.
Well, I mean, it's very nice. I mean, actually, we can go straight into one because...
Prepare to hear yourself.
Prepare to hear yourself.
Peter, that's horrifying.
The ghost of Peter Buck past.
I mean, you're talking about making the decision to not automatically tour every time you release an album, which I found... think's very interesting, and probably one of the reasons why as a band you managed to keep your sanity is you weren't on the album tour treadmill, you know, which kills so many other bands. Let's have a listen to this. It's good stuff.
In the South, in Georgia, there still isn't a showbiz thing. There isn't a rock and roll, you know, road to success. So we kind of just made it up, and we toured and made a little independent record by ourselves and signed a little small label. And just, you know, we were kind of approaching it as opposed to like some showbiz thing, just like what we do. You know, okay, we can play here, we can go play there.
And day to day.
Yeah, as far as that goes, you know, so we did it now. Well, we'll make a record, we won't tour this time. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I guess it looks from the outside like there's some overall master plan going on, but you just kind of go, well, this makes sense today.
You'd probably stand by that, I'm imagining, Peter. Sounds like the sort of thing you might say now.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's nice to hear you.
I mean, I like to have a future plan, but I never follow it. You know, I mean, you know, I mean, I've got all kinds of things I'd like to accomplish in the next 3 or 4 years, and we'll see if I get to any of them. But, you know, yeah, in the background we came from, we weren't really thinking that, oh, yeah, there's a career to be made here, and this is... You know, we didn't have a Hollywood manager. Our manager was a guy that I knew from the record store who was happened to be a lawyer. But, you know, he still manages me. Bert has been my manager for 42 years. So, you know, we didn't have any of these connections where people are telling us, oh, yeah, you need to do this Spider-Man soundtrack and, you know, do all this. It just wasn't going to – I mean, none of that was happening. It was like, yeah, we made a record, we sent it out, and people would buy it.
Yeah.
In this interview, you talk about how you measure success. You talk about the writing of the songs, about Michael as a lyricist. Interesting, you talk about the optimal length of albums because you're already reacting against the CDization of the album length when suddenly albums go from 45 minutes to 60-plus minutes. And, you know, how you find that problematic. Also about kind of how bands kind of run their course and, you know, how some bands should have broken up before they actually broke up. Let's have a listen to this clip. It's on that.
Every time you make a record, every time you write a song, you think, why am I doing this? Am I doing pay the mortgage? You know, or this is what we do. You know, I mean, to a certain degree, when I was younger, I'd look at these people and go, just why don't they quit, you know? But, I mean, again, what am I going to do? Stay home, you know? If we start making bad records, I'll quit making records.
That's right.
As long as we're doing good work.
And we get along.
See, the thing is that most of those bands were famous from the very first day. You know, it's like the Rolling Stones, I was reading one of those books about them. And, like, they were 19, and they'd done, like, 4 months of gigs, and they were playing just 5,000 screaming 14 months. We played in obscurity, I mean, complete obscurity for, like, 6 years. You know, we had our first 4 records out, and nobody except for, like, rock journalists, college kids, that was it. Didn't sell any records. So for me, it's like we're a new band to a certain degree for you know, it's not like we've been in the public eye. I think it's kept us fresh. I mean,
yeah, everything has changed, you know, over the last 5 or 6 years, and that keeps it different. You know.
And you sort of allude to the fact that, you know, you were rock critics darlings for sure and college kids darlings. But I mean, I remember seeing you in January 1982 in Atlanta at the 688 Club and just being knocked out. And then you came to the Marquee. You played the Marquee in London. It was just really one of the the greatest shows I've ever seen, Peter. In that interview with Anthony, you talk about these crazy reviews you were getting in the UK press, and you say, no band should get reviews like that. I think mine was probably one of them, because it was just so like, you know, wow, this is just the greatest new American band, one of those. But it really was. And I still have this, which was sent to me from Radio Free Europe, the single. I think it's worth quite a lot of money now, isn't it, that Hibtone single?
Yeah, it's funny. All the guys in the REM band were on a text chain because somebody had written one of us and said, look, I managed to find one of these. It was only $200. And we're like, Jesus. And none of us own a copy of it. Nobody. Like,
really?
We're like, nope. Bill gave his to an ex-high school girlfriend who got drunk and left it in her car and it melted. And I don't know where mine went. I'm just like, yep, I kind of thought I'd have all that stuff, but no, I don't have any of it at all.
Do you guys want to start bidding for my copy?
No, you know what? If I had all the crap I'd put out over the years, I'd have to get another house. I got four records that I wrote and played on in the mail last week. I'm like, where am I going to put these? I mean, I just don't have any space.
Yeah, but this is like a holy relic. Come on. It's such a great record, too. I mean, I just remember putting on Radio Free Europe the first time and just thinking, oh, wow, this is just so much better than all this terrible pop music that's coming out of London right now. But that was just me. Luke, it's probably a good thing that since you're rude about just about everybody else in Bad Vibes, you don't say anything about REM. That's probably a good thing. What was your take on REM in the 80s and before you met Peter?
Well, they were. I mean, it's one of those things that they were.
Album number three hangs in the balance here.
Yeah, it was a thing that was kind of. There, that was no one was kind of how do you say that? It's, when I did my okay, here you go. I think when I did about my third gig in one of my teenage bands, and we were pretty good actually. We were all right. We weren't that bad. We had some of our own songs, and some guy came up to me, and he said, "Have you heard of REM?" And I said, "No." He said, "You want to get their album Murmur because your stuff sounds a bit like that." It didn't, but I got Murmur. So from there on. I've always sort of been into it. I like Monster's my favourite album. So
we were playing What's the Frequency, Kenneth, earlier today, and it still really rocks, Peter. I think it never fails to get me off my seat. I love that track. What's the frequency, Kenneth? This year been so dream. Peter, what did you make of like the Auteurs and perhaps Britpop in general? What was your, were you kind of aware of it at all? Or you were just like floating above it?
No, I always read and I always buy the records. I actually got an advanced cassette of the Auteurs record. I remember doing, you know, Monster was about to come out and we're doing some big BBC. It was like, I can't remember what it was, but you know, the woman asked what I was listening to, and I said, I think the Auteurs are the best band in this whole Britpop thing. And she goes, well, why? I said, well, they write real songs, first of all, which wasn't necessarily the case with everyone in Britpop. I love a lot of those bands.
Yeah.
But Auteurs are my favorite of the group. I mean, that first record alone is just super classic songwriting. And then when it totally went off the rails, I thought it was even better.
Yeah, I liked it when it went off the rails. Can I just say what we did say on tour, Peter and I? We had a discussion sort of about the 90s, and we both agreed that, and I'm saying this without any kind of irony at all, that the first Menswear album is a lot better than the Oasis albums. That's genuine. It's not meant to be. I'm not taking the piss out of Menswear or anything like that, but that was a kind of genuine conversation that we had. So it's worth putting that out there.
We were on tour in England and, you know, I'd read about Menswear every day for like, you know, the whole month. And Scott McCoy picked up Melody Maker and goes, woohoo, the second Menswear single's out. And it's like, I would assume they had five albums that didn't written about to such a degree. And I did like the record, actually. You know, I felt sorry for him because you could see how it was going to go immediately afterwards.
So the Menswear revival starts here?
Well, let's not go too far. But...
I seem to remember Menswear were one of those kind of Camden, but you write quite a lot about Camden. You lived in Camden.
I did.
And they sort of fell foul of that rather, you know, sort of hedonistic life, didn't they?
It's a thing that kind of gets close to the serious point about it is it's always gone on in pop music, but it gets close to abuse and exploitation of very young kids by adults who should know a lot better or don't, because they're, you know, I don't want to get too moralistic about it, but that's a lot of that was going on. Yeah. A lot of very young bands were getting signed up and given much more money than they knew what to do with. And their career, you could tell, I could see people's careers of like, you've got a career of two singles. Not that anyone should think of, if you're doing this, you shouldn't really think of it as a career or anything, but it's just what it is. It's just like, you know, if you're still here like fucking 5,000 years later as I am, then, you know, well done me or something, I don't know, but that's sort of what was happening. There's a lot of kind of much older guys, A&R guys, who are probably in their mid-30s, sort of chucking a lot of bad stuff at 19-year-old kids. That's the way I read it now.
Yeah. Do either of you miss like being in bands, like on a day-to-day kind of basis? Do you ever pine for those days, or are you quite happy being sort of more or less free agents and able to do things like the records you've done together?
I don't want to be in a band.
I'm not with the band, as Sylvia Patterson said.
Yeah.
Peter, what about you?
I feel really lucky to have had the experiences I had and have no interest in repeating them. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of times I wish that I played more, but I could, you know, I play every day at my house. I write songs every day. And, you know, I think I'm going to have 3 or 4 records out this year that I co-wrote and co-produced or whatever. But yeah, I don't think I want to tie myself to that year-long process of, oh, we're going to make a record, then we're going to tour, and we're going to do the video. It's like, oh, all that stuff just makes my skin crawl now. Mm. You know, I'm looking forward to touring with Luke in February. And actually, Luke could be getting a track for me like in 2 days that I just finished. So
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
it was meant to be arriving on Monday, but you know. Well,
I recorded it on Monday, and Scott still has to put the bass on and mix it. So he might be doing a synth job too. So
nice.
It should be soon.
Nice. Good.
Oh, I'm glad we were able to, you know,
facilitate
an exclusive.
An exclusive. Yeah. That's going out on the internet immediately after this. So listen, well, thanks both of you. We haven't had time to talk about so many other things. Bader Meinhof, Black Box Recorder. I reviewed the Black Box Recorder album that had the fact. Was it the first one that had the Facts of Life on it?
Great record. That's the second one.
Second one. England Made Me was the
first one. Yeah.
And then it was. Well, I still love the Facts of Life. It's still on my, you know.
What about the first one? Don't you like that?
I'm just talking about the Facts of Life itself. That track, I think, is just such a classic. It's still on my kind of favorite playlist. It pops up from time to time, and I always enjoy it. It's just the facts of life. Thank you both of you for sharing, you know, sharing your reflections and recollections of bygone days. Please stick around to just chip in with any thoughts you might have on. We need to talk about Pharoah Sanders, who died on September 24th. So I'm going to hand over to, you know, I'm a jazz ignoramus, so I usually hand over to my colleagues to tell us a bit about the greatness of Pharoah Sanders. So, you know, Mark, what's your take on the great man?
Well, I think he's tremendously interesting because what he did was so varied that more than any of his, I mean, his guy emerged as part of John Coltrane's late band in the mid 60s, but he was never locked into that particular area or way of playing. So the sheer variety of the stuff is astonishing. I mean, Jasper, you're a pretty big fan, yeah?
Yeah.
What stuff do you particularly like?
Starting with the most recent thing, I think the album that he did last year with Floating Points and the LSO, yeah, London Symphony Orchestra is just a wonderful record.
It's beautiful.
It's really beautiful. Very, very beautiful and very moving. And I think it's a fitting kind of end point to his recording career. And I think going back, I mean, we were talking the other day about the Alice Coltrane album that he did. And you know, the early 70s when he's really kind of exploring the more sort of spiritual jazz kind of angle. But yeah, massively varied, incredible tone, incredible sound, so focused on just the texture of sound, yeah, and those, I mean, the sheets of sound as it's often referred to. I just find that it's imbued with a lot of feeling, and you can tell that through playing so much free stuff, when he then does come to a more structured surrounding, it mm-hmm. gives him this, he kind of gets to float down onto it rather than having to build up to it. I don't know.
I think he's capable of a sort of beauty that actually not many of his contemporaries were, where a lot of those people who came out of free jazz are hyper aggressive. I mean, I think to some extent people like Albert Eiler sort of fall slightly into that category, whilst Pharoah sort of actually was capable of producing great beauty as a tenor player.
He does retain a sort of kind of melodic thing quite a lot of the time, which you get, which is less so, like you said, with like the likes of Albert Eiler. And the last 6 months or so, I've been playing the Karma album quite a lot. It's one of those things. And I like the fact that there's kind of, there's almost sort of like, although they're kind of long kind of mantras and stuff, there's sort of songs on it, but it's actually, you know, there's actually lyrics and stuff like that, which is quite, you know, like, I suppose, like, you know, I guess, you know, like the Coltrane thing, if you know, when they suddenly kind of go into a chant and that stuff. Yeah.
Sure.
Yes. It's worth mentioning that Don Snowden, the great LA writer who now resides in Valencia, but was at a mainstay of the LA scene, has written, especially for us, a very personal homage to appreciation of Saunders, which is the main piece in the longer bisection on the homepage. But there's also an interview that Chris Ingham did with Saunders in 2000. It's just a short piece, but there's some nice quotes in there. Peter, are you a sort of Saunders fan? Are you someone who you listen to? I know you have very eclectic tastes.
Yeah, you know, I probably wasn't really familiar with him until the 80s, you know, and there wasn't really any critical consensus. I didn't read a lot of jazz writing, so I just kind of bought records used and played them and loved them. I think the more free and out there he got, the more I liked it, you know, because, you know, I write song structures. So to hear someone working on something that's not structured but is really emotional is great. Mm. That said, the Floating Points record is not what I look for from him. But it was still really beautiful. I mean, it was very composed. There wasn't a lot of freeform stuff. It was, you know, but it was just a really great piece of music. And I thought it was an interesting way to use his talent.
Right at the end, it builds up. And like, as you say, it's very composed and very kind of, mellow in a way. I mean, Don Snowden mentions that in his piece, that he hasn't actually listened to it, but it sounded a bit laid back for my tastes. It is extremely, you know, laid back, but also very beautiful. And I think when it builds up to those sheets of sound moments, they're all the more potent for the contrast they provide to what's preceded them. For me, when it's just eventually after like half an hour, 40 minutes, explodes into this wall of saxophone, it's I find it magical.
Beautiful. It's really nice to hear from all of you on Pharoah Saunders. We also lost the rapper Coolio yesterday, or day before yesterday. Most famous, obviously, for, you know, Gangster's Paradise, which was a huge hit. I don't have a huge amount to say about him. I think of him as a almost like a one-hit wonder, has not been a particularly important figure in hip-hop really for a long time, a bit of a sort of clownish figure. I mean, Mark, are you? How would you contextualize Coolio?
Well, very, very similar. My experience with him is very similar to yours. It's basically essentially the one hit. We were listening in the office today to some of his stuff, and what strikes me is how slow and sluggish so much of it is. You know, it's by hip hop. I mean, let's see, he's loosely a contemporary of the Compton, the NWA, and all that sort of group of people.
Yes.
And they're a lot funkier. Dre, as a producer, is a lot funkier. Coolio's stuff really isn't funky. It's,
no.
It's very slow. It's quite stodgy, which gives it a sort of certain mad elegance, I think you could say. You know, but am I a huge fan? No, can't pretend.
I like the fact that he wanted to be a cook. You know, he's in 2013, he started selling off his music rights to fund his career as a chef. And he had a cooking show and published a book, Cooking with Coolio, 5-star meals at a 1-star price. I wrote that.
Good man.
Luke, Peter, do either of you possess any of Coolio's cookery books?
No, but I do. My only comment really is that you mentioned the Facts of Life, and the string, the kind of synth string part was directly ripped off of Gangster's Paradise.
Oh,
on
nice.
That record. So nice. If you listen to that,
it all makes sense.
Didn't that come from a Stevie Wonder record?
Probably, yes. Yeah, probably.
Pastime Paradise.
Yeah. There you go.
I met him once, and we talked about politics for 20 minutes. It was on election eve, and he was kind of dumbfounded about how Bush could win. And I was like, well, it's kind of the people in Ohio right now. And he goes, man, fuck Ohio. And that is why my moment was Coolio.
Very
excellent.
Good.
Excellent.
That's wonderful. I love the fact that I imagine that probably was an awards show or something. You must have, in situations like that, you must have had conversations with people you probably wouldn't have had conversations with otherwise.
Actually, we were in a bar watching the whichever election it was. I think it was 2005. Okay. And he was just like, man, I don't get this. I'm like, I don't really get it either.
Well, yeah, if he was still alive, no doubt, as we kind of limber up to midterms and the prospect of Trump's return, he might still be saying, fuck Ohio and fuck Indiana and fuck Montana and a lot of other American states. Anyway, so Coolio, I think he was only 50 years old, so that's a very young age to go. But I don't know what's cooking. They say I got to learn, but nobody's here to teach me. If they can't understand it, how can they reach me? I guess they can't, I guess they won't, I guess they front. That's why I know my life is out of luck, fool. Come on. Jasper, do you have any pieces you want to just briefly tell us about?
I've got a few. From last week, Maureen Cleave, who, as everyone, regular listeners to this podcast will know, I'm rather keen on as a writer. She went with the Beatles to New York in 1964, their very first visit, and reported it basically every day. We've got about four or five of these, which are going up one after the other. And this is the first one. She talks about the actual how they're greeted at the airport. She talks about the fans saying, "We want the Beatles," they cried indiscriminately as they waved banners saying, "Beatles stay here," and "Beatles unfair to bald men," and curiously enough, "England get out of Ireland." So yeah. I just love that. Right, Dennis Wilson, been interviewed by Richard Green for The Enemy in June 69. "I've lived in a beautiful home in Beverly Hills, in harems, in the mountains, with a family, but where I like best is where I am now." Obviously, the family is the Manson family, which had yet to sort of be exposed. But later on, at the very end of the interview, Mike Love is kind of, the Richard Green starts asking Mike Love some questions. Mike Love comes out with some really repellent stuff about his bandmates. And this is him on Brian Wilson. He says, "He is completely ignorant of the situation, except he knows there are a few thousand dollars hanging around the bank, and that's broke to him. He has not got the business acumen to know about it. He enjoys being in a muddle by virtue of being sorry for himself." Well, you know, that's fucking charming, Mike, you know. But then Holly Graham Nash, to be interviewed by Nick Jones in 67, it says, youth is beautiful. It's also innocent. All that we'd like to do, all that I feel one should do, is teach people things so that they grow up to be nice people. So this is like, you know, the proto-hippie Holly Graham Nash, who's on his way to see Crosby and Stills, even 2 years before the fact. Last thing from last week I'd like to mention is Leon Russell live at the Royal Albert Hall, London, reviewed by Mark Plummer. It's a fine review. He likes it a lot. My little story is, it was my 15th birthday. It was about a couple of weeks before this. This is February 71. And my parents had given me enough money to go to see a band at the Albert Hall. I got tickets to see this concert, Leon Russell. They also gave me enough money to take my friends out to seed the macrobiotic restaurant on Westbourne Park Road. And it just turned out there was also enough money to buy three caps of very, very good LSD and a lump of Lebanese hash. So we get to the Albert Hall high as kites. And at the bottom of the bill is Status Quo, who at that point were just reinventing themselves as a boogie band. And so I have this memory of them sort of jumping up and down in the lights and, you know, the acid sort of doing the trick with that, while the whole of the Albert Hall was like velvet, going dark and light and dark and light. Second on the bill was Juicy Lucy, who had a hit with Who Do You Love, that version of Who Do You Love. They were pretty good. Grease Band were next on the bill. Joe Cocker's old backing band, who were lovely. They were playing sort of like limber sort of country funk, not a million miles away from the sort of music the band were playing around that sort of time. And then Leon Russell came on. He had Claude Lanier wearing little more than a black string vest. And it was the best show I've ever seen in my life. It was absolutely astonishing. And years later, Don Nix, who was part of the Leon Russell organization, says that was the best show he ever saw Leon Russell play. This week, what have we got? Otis Redding being reviewed by Pete Johnson in the LA Times in April 1966. He's playing the Whiskey, and he says, Redding drives each number mercilessly, shouting and preaching each song with relentless energy through the enormous sound of his band. Redding was assured of an in-group following Thursday night when, among his spectators, emerged Bob Dylan, trailed by an entourage of camp followers.
Yeah, that's quite famous. I think Otis wanted him to write a song for him, didn't he? So sort of asked Dylan to write him a song.
I just thought I'd chuck in the Leon Russell story, just so everyone knows what a degenerate 15-year-old I was.
Leon Russell ever mean anything to you, Peter, as a Southern American?
Yeah, I think you can find it on the web. It's this Leon Russell live on like KNET or something from 1969. And yes, it had Claudia Lanier in a bikini top.
Yeah.
And I was watching it at my parents' house because I was 12 or whatever. And my dad was just completely silent watching the thing. And I don't think he was digging the music. And I loved the music. And Leon Russell was the first or second real rock concert I went to when I was 13.
Oh, right. Wow.
Right.
In Georgia. Wow. And at the local wrestling arena.
Fantastic.
Excellent.
I mean, I adored the Mad Dogs and Englishmen album, and that was what led me to Leon Russell very directly, was Mad Dogs and Englishmen. Who is this guy who put this band together and so on? Fantastic noise. It's just great.
Bring things full circle. John Mendelsohn wrote the very short, like, liner notes for Mad Dogs and Englishmen. Did you know that, Mark?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, yeah. Jasper, have you got anything?
Yeah, I've got
us?
A couple of things to mention. First, which I added a few weeks ago, is Arif Mardin, an interview Tom Doyle did with him in Sound on Sound in July 2004, which is very nice, Sound on Sound, a relatively technical magazine. Mardin claims to be anything but an equipment head. So this is more of a technical interview, he wonders, a slight touch of trepidation in his voice. The only problem is if you ask me about which blah blah do you use for this, I can only tell you it's the blue one or the red one. I know what they can do, but I don't really follow every technical magazine. But he goes into his mixing technique about how it's informed by his time back at Atlantic in the 50s and 60s. Tom Dowd used to say, voice and bass, make them zero. Then the kick may be half a decibel softer and the rest just sprinkled around. That's why when Ahmet Ertegun heard Tommy's work when he was 16 years old, he said, this young boy has the correct bass and drum level to my liking, hire him. That was the R&B sound. I just think it's a lovely interview.
That's fabulous. Well, I'm sure we all revere the late Arif Mardin. I think he was some kind of genius as an arranger and producer. I really do. Do we all love Arif Mardin's records?
Yes.
I'm not aware. I'm afraid.
I mean, it depends. I mean, how central is black music to your life? And it just so happens that in a couple of our cases, certainly, I think Barney and Jasper and myself all say that black music is absolutely central. And some of his stuff is just sensational.
Exquisitely good, yeah.
Yeah.
Next up is an interview with Harry Styles, or a comment on Harry Styles, teen star turned serious player from 2017, Jude Rogers in The Observer, which I thought was interesting because it feels like he's having a bit of a moment now in 2022 with, what is it, Don't Worry, Darling, the film that he's in and all that drama and all, I don't know what's going on with that. But I like this piece because, better still, Styles is happy to celebrate the young woman who supported his career from the start, as he did loudly when asked if he was worried about proving his credibility to older, cooler people. Who's to say that young girls who like pop music have worse musical taste than a 30-year-old hipster guy? That's not up to you to say, which I kind of rate, you know, just back it. And then lastly, How We Made Car Wash, Rose Royce, Dave Simpson does in The Guardian. And it's one of those pieces where they go and, you know, look back on how it was all done. But Gwen Dickey, the singer in Rose Royce, just tells a story of meeting Norman Whitfield. I was singing in a band called The Jewels and was spotted and recommended to Norman Whitfield. I had no idea he was a legendary Motown songwriter and producer. I went to meet him at his mansion in Beverly Hills and said, "Sir, why do you have all these gold and platinum records on your walls?" He dropped to the floor and laughed for 20 minutes. Later, everyone went, "The Norman Whitfield, The Temptations, Marvin Gaye." But I was this little girl from Biloxi in Mississippi. I never read the names on the back of albums.
Yeah.
Unlike us guys here, right? Yeah. There you go. That's great. Fantastic. Well, listen, it's been an absolute blast speaking with you, fine gentlemen. We wish you the very best of luck with the new album, which I think is out in a few weeks, isn't it? Officially out end of October.
End of October, I think. Yeah. And then I think it's probably out in America that month later or something. I don't know. It's out on an American label. I can't remember what the label is.
So. You can't remember the name of the label?
No.
That's quite a lot in itself. But it's Cherry Red here.
It's a label in America.
It's a label in America.
You heard it here first, folks. The album is coming out.
You'll find it.
Yeah. It's a great name,
find
actually,
out.
For
Tune
a
in.
Label. Yeah, a label in America.
Yeah.
Tune in on the 28th of October to find out why all the kids are super bummed out.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, so thanks everyone for listening to this episode. Go to Rock's Back Pages, subscribe. It might be worth finding out whether your local library subscribes, and if it doesn't, why don't you ask them to at least trial Rock's Back Pages. There's a hell of a lot there, 50,000 articles, 800 audio interviews. It is a veritable museum of popular music. So listen, it just remains for us to thank you both, Luke and Peter, for joining us today. Yeah,
fantastic.
And Peter, you can probably go back to bed now if you want. I know it's very early for you in Oregon.
Yeah, it is indeed.
Thank you both, guys, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. But thanks, and we'll say goodbye at this point.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That concludes episode 137 of the Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guests Luke Haynes and Peter Buck. Their new album, All the Kids Are Super Bummed Out, is out October 28th on Cherry Red. The hosts were Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Muris and Bowie. The Rock's Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.